Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, activist historian Howard Zinn gets kicked out of Atlanta, lands in Boston, travels to Hanoi, and continues empowering the afflicted and afflicting the powerful. It's an inspiring story. I hope you'll stay tuned. We return to the fine documentary by Deb Ellis and Dennis Mueller, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. It's about the life and times of the admirable professor, political activist, and historian Howard Zinn. Zinn's talks have appeared regularly on New World Notes, and you may well be familiar with his very influential book, A People's History of the United States, published in 1980. In the 1950s, Zinn was teaching at a staid, genteel black college in the South, Spelman College in Atlanta. At the same time, the civil rights movement burst forth in the South, and many Spelman students became active participants in the civil rights protests and demonstrations, much to the dismay of the Spelman trustees, and to the delight of Zinn. Zinn himself was both a scholar of the civil rights movement and a very active participant in it. In today's installment, Spelman College fires Zinn. He lands on his feet in Boston at Boston University. Soon, a different political and social crusade envelops him, ending the Vietnam War. Zinn becomes a very active anti-war activist, even flying to Hanoi in 1968 with Daniel Berrigan to secure the release of some American POWs. In World War II, Zinn had been a bombardier in the Air Force. Now, in Hanoi, Zinn had his first experience of being on the ground when the U.S. bombs hit. The experience had a profound effect on him and on his subsequent writing. In addition to Zinn, today we'll hear reflections from many American greats, including Alice Walker, Noam Chomsky, Staunton Lind, Father Daniel Berrigan, Tom Hayden, and Daniel Ellsberg. So let us return to the life and times of Howard Zinn. We'll pick up in Atlanta, circa 1963, then on to Boston and Hanoi.
His activism was not at all loved by anybody, hardly. I mean, maybe one or two teachers.
When the students came back to the campus after being in jail, after protesting, and then rebelled against the restrictions on campus, against the way they were treated, the way they were patronized by the college administration, and I supported them in that internal struggle, that was too much.
He was fired, after all, you know, from Spelman.
This guy is bounced out of Spelman College in the most traumatic imaginable circumstances.
Labor activist and former Spelman College colleague Staunton Lind.
The Spelman administration waits until after the students have all left campus. That was the key. And then just axed him.
This is my favorite place here. It's Dunkin' Donuts, but because it's Harvard, they don't want to call themselves Dunkin' Donuts openly, so they call themselves the Elliott Street Cafe. But if you look closely inside, it's Dunkin' Donuts. It's really funny. I wrote two books about the South, actually, and I've been started to write articles about what was happening in the South around me, you know, living in the black community, what, you know, the swirl of events, the civil rights movement beginning to develop, and so even before the sit-ins. And I wrote an article for Harper's Magazine, began writing for The Nation. Then Beacon Press, which is a publisher in Boston, asked if I would write a history about the NAACP and the Southern movement. And I wrote back to them and I said, you don't understand. The NAACP is not the heart of the Southern movement. the heart of the Southern movement, SNCC, this unknown group of young people. And so, okay, I wrote a book about SNCC.
SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
SNCC represents the closest thing we have in the United States to that militant mood of change which one finds in emerging nations abroad. It constantly aims to create and recreate, out of the bodies of poor and powerless people, a new force, nonviolent but aggressive, honest and therefore unmanageable. It wants to demonstrate to the nation not what kind of system people should believe in, but how people should live their lives. So its radicalism is not an ideology, but a mood. Moods are harder to define. They are also harder to imprison.
Certainly the writing of the book, The New Abolitionist, set a tone. And I think that that might have led us to some degree to have that kind of little intellectual edge about us.
And so what Howard did was lift us onto the pages of history and really made us conscious that we were involved in a struggle that had historical weight.
One of the things that comes through when you look at someone like Howard is you recognize that being a historian or being a journalist doesn't relieve you of your other civic responsibilities. I assume that mainstream historians also go and vote, but somehow we find it a little bit more challenging when we find out they go out and protest also.
I remember in his book when he's talking about the Hattiesburg Freedom Day, and he has a scene in there where he comes into the courtroom. When he gets in there, he finds that some black people have been sitting on the white side, and he's going to sit on the black side.
There was an extremely tense moment when the Hattiesburg chief law officer said, "Now, there's a colored side and a white side, and I want all the colored people to move to that side and the white people to move to the other side." Nobody moves.
And then one of the police officers starts moving towards him, and Howard raises his hand. And the judge asks him if he has something to say. And he says that the Supreme Court has ruled that it's illegal to segregate in any courtroom in the United States. And would you mind following the law of the Supreme Court?
And it was one of those marvelous moments when authority and tradition of a bad kind is challenged, and just because of firmness and willingness to risk what could have been a bloodbath, you know, in the wrong hands, there was at least that moment of change.
Democracy is not just a counting up of votes. It is a counting up of actions. Without those on the bottom acting out their desires for justice, as the government acts out its needs, and those with power and privilege act out theirs, the scales of democracy will be off. That is why civil disobedience is not just to be tolerated. If we are to have a truly democratic society, it is a necessity.
Activist Tom Hayden.
What's interesting to me is that both Stott and Lynn and Howard Zinn, the only white professors that I remember who joined the civil rights movement and taught in black colleges, were also the first to go with me to North Vietnam.
Adlai Stevenson, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations.
In Southeast Asia, we want nothing more and nothing less than the assured and guaranteed independence of the peoples of that area. We are in Southeast Asia to help our friends preserve their own opportunity to be free of imported terror, of alien assassination managed by the North Vietnam communists based in Hanoi and backed by the Chinese communists from Peking.
Daniel Ellsberg.
Telling the truth, a truth that the president doesn't want told, can be very powerful. You have the chance, if you know a truth that politicians are trying to conceal, you have the chance, just by telling it effectively, to save a great many lives. And that's a power that you don't have every day.
Now, this was in the beginning of 68. The Tet Offensive is on in Vietnam, and there's a sudden uprising of rebellion, Viet Cong, a National Liberation Front, all over South Vietnam. And while I'm teaching my seminar, somebody comes in to the seminar and says to me, I have a telephone call for you. So I told the class to wait, and I went out, and there was Dave Dellinger on the other end of the line, and says, well, you know, the North Vietnamese have decided that as a gesture at the time of the Tet holiday in Vietnam, they want to release the first three airmen. I said, well, okay, when? Tomorrow morning. That was it. I packed my bag, and the next morning I was in an apartment in Greenwich Village, meeting Dave Dellinger, Tom Hayden, and for the first time, Dan Berrigan. And we hopped on a plane that day and flew halfway around the world.
What indications from North Vietnam have you had that you'll be able to pick these men up?
Well, the sole thing that I'm aware of was a telegram sent from Hanoi and arriving, I believe, when was it, Sunday?
And it was addressed to Dave Dellinger, the American peace movement, and it said that the North Vietnamese were prepared to release three American airmen if the peace movement would send a representative to Hanoi.
So you expect to get the men or have the men released to your custody in Hanoi, not here?
That's what we expect, yeah.
Anti-war activist Father Daniel Berrigan.
It was, you know, the other side of the moon for both of us. The Tet uprising had occurred in South Vietnam, in Saigon, and everything was frozen, including ourselves.
Remember, they even got into the embassy, they took over the American embassy in Saigon. It was a very frightening thing for the American establishment and the American public. And so we, Dan Berrigan and I, spent a week in Vientiane. Before the plane finally was able to get out of Saigon, come to Vientiane in Laos and take us on a strange trip through the night to Hanoi.
We were in night shelters, bomb shelters in the hotel practically every night. We toured the shelters of the city. Practically all children had been evacuated.
Well, we saw Hanoi under siege and war, and we experienced bombings every day in Hanoi. And this is my first time on the receiving end. It was a sobering experience to feel what it was like being bombed rather than bombing.
Then one day, suddenly, all these things happened suddenly. We were brought unexpectedly into a big hall, into this blinding light, into this international forest of cameras and of news people, and they paraded the three airmen into the room, still in their prison uniform. We had an agreement with the White House that they would be in our custody back to New York, and that would be honored. We landed in Vientiane. Aboard came this unspeakable character, Robert Sullivan, ambassador to Laos.
They will fly in the air attaché's aircraft to Udon, remain overnight there, and return by most expeditious means to the United States.
The representatives of the embassy here in Vientiane, while talking about free choice for the pilots, made it clear that the United States preferred that they go back by military plane.
Major, you were in the plane there for about 40-45 minutes. What was the discussion all about?
I'm not at liberty to discuss that.
Not only did the North Vietnamese make it clear to us that this question of the pilots going home by a non-military plane was important, but they made it clear to the pilots. And I recall that when we suggested that the people in Washington making this decision had not been to North Vietnam recently or not recently, they had not talked with the North Vietnamese, and that perhaps we and the pilots knew something about the North Vietnamese attitude which they did not know. Whereupon the ambassador came back with, I thought, a marvelous answer. He said that one of the persons in Washington making this decision was a man who had survived a Japanese prison camp and had come out of it weighing 97 pounds, period. At which point, Father Berrigan said, these men don't weigh 97 pounds. I don't see the analogy.
In fact, Father Berrigan and I, on our way back, this may be seen presumptuous on our part, but when on our way back from Paris, we sent a wire, I think with our last 15 bucks, to the White House, saying something like, we'd like to talk to you, President Johnson. You know, would you please meet with us? We just come back from Hanoi. We've just talked with the Premier Pham Van Dong. We just read in the newspaper that you say the North Vietnamese are not ready to negotiate. What we learned from Pham Van Dong seems to contradict that. We'd like to talk with you about this and about the prisoner release, which we think has been mishandled, but we have not so far received an answer from LBJ.
At this day.
Vice President Hubert Humphrey.
I know many people have said, look, we've killed innocent people. Our bombs have killed civilians and babies and mothers. And I suppose there is truth to that. There have been people that have been killed. But your government has not bombed civilians. Your government has not bombed open cities. Your government has sent its bombers in after targets, military targets, that have been placed in an area surrounded by civilians.
I was in North Vietnam during the war, and I saw the effects of these cluster bombs on little kids, and little round bombs that contain hundreds and hundreds of steel pellets. And when the bomb explodes, these pellets shoot out and they enter the bodies of people, and almost all civilians, just farmers and their families. And then they're very, very hard surgically to get out.
Tom Hayden.
One of the strangest things that happened was we were very interested in knowing how the Vietnamese withstood this bombing. And so far to the north of Hanoi, they took us to a mountain that had caves in it where they had fought against the Chinese and the Japanese and the French before the Americans. And it was like an underground world, kind of thing that you would see in a Star Wars movie now. And so we had a dinner and a meeting in this cave. It was the size of a basketball auditorium. And then the thing that the Vietnamese always do is they all get up and sing songs about their struggle or traditional songs of the country. And then whether you can sing or not, they ask you to stand up and sing. So Howard sang America the Beautiful.
Zinn holding a press conference, 1968.
The domino theory is one of those great pieces of nonsense which the administration keeps uttering and which any student of international affairs, I think, can demolish in a very short time. How did Vietnam fall? If Vietnam is about to fall, did it fall because of something that came from abroad? It fell because of internal conditions, or it's falling because of internal conditions in Vietnam. The best way to make sure that a country turns to communism is to put foreign military forces in it, because then the communists will have a nationalist cause which they can use against the foreign power.
Noam Chomsky.
And when his book came out, I think 1966 or so, there wasn't a, you know, it was so inconsistent with the drift of thinking and understanding that most people couldn't even read it. They couldn't read the words.
Vietnam, it seems, has become a theater of the absurd. Early in 1966, a new pacification technique was developed by American soldiers. It involved surrounding a village, killing as many young men as could be found, and then taking away the women and children by helicopter. The Americans called this procedure Operation County Fair.
I was very conscious of the role of the historian and how a historian who didn't use his, her knowledge to play some role in what was the most serious issue before the nation was somebody who was neglecting his or her duty to education, to students.
My first encounter with Howard was literally my first day as a freshman at BU. I arrived there, and almost immediately, hundreds of students, you know, swarmed into the Marsh Chapel and provided a sanctuary for a soldier who had gone AWOL from a military base near Boston. He'd been given orders to ship out to Vietnam. He came to BU and, you know, was immediately supported by people there. It was a 24-hour day, you know, teach-in, really. It was music, people bringing in food, people speaking around the clock. And Howard probably spoke a half a dozen times during that week, and it was very inspiring to me. I mean, he was spellbinding and making connections between the war and civil disobedience, the history of war during the 20th century, his own experience as a bombing pilot in World War II. And it just, I'd never seen anything like it before.
Students were expected to be quiet and live in the dormitory and, you know, be supported by mom and dad and take classes and do as they're told. You know. Then along came the 60s and people like Zinn and the students of my generation. And all of a sudden, we were getting involved in issues right there on the campus that had been considered outside of our purview completely.
That's what they mean when they say the 60s ruined education. That is, there was this incredible life that suddenly came into the universities as the world entered the university and the university entered the world.
Eventually, Boston University did become a hot point of student protest against the war. And the hotter it got, the more we depended on Howard Zinn to support us, because while other faculty members thought that sometimes we'd gone too far, Zinn was always right there, indeed, backing us up and giving us the intellectual justification for our points of view.
So now this guy is trying to get tenure at Boston University. And looks like, I think he didn't get it one time, and this is a second time around. All it needs is the vote of the trustees. So the students come to him and ask him to speak against the war, and he doesn't really connect the two things. He said, well, sure, because if you were in Howard's position, or you always said sure. And then it gets a little closer, and you say, well, where is this going to be? And they say, well, right outside the such-and-such hotel, because we're trying to speak to the trustees, and it begins to dawn on, now, wait a minute. These are the same trustees that on that same day are going to be voting on my tenure. And then he says, and who else will be speaking? Oh, you're the only one. And he says, yes, yes, I'll speak. And by the time he speaks, the trustees have voted. Who knows what would have happened had the chronology been otherwise, but that's how it came down.
Nonviolence does not mean acceptance, but resistance. Not waiting, but acting. It is not at all passive. It involves strikes, boycotts, non-cooperation, mass demonstrations, and sabotage, as well as appeals to the conscience of the world, even to individuals in the oppressing group who might break away from their past. Direct action does not deride using the political rights, the civil liberties, even the voting mechanisms in those societies where they are available, but it recognizes the limitations of those controlled rights and goes beyond.
The law is not a holy thing. I remember, and Dan Berrigan broke the law, and they interviewed his 80-year-old mother, and they said, oh, what do you think about your son? What do you think about him breaking the law? I guess they thought an 80-year-old woman would have 80 years of respect for the law behind her, and she'd give them the right answer. And Dan Berrigan's mother said, it's not God's law. And she had it there. The law is made by very mortal people. Very limited people, very opinionated people, and people who have very special interests. They make the law, they tell us what the law is, and then they act as if it's holy writ.
A lot of people are troubled by civil disobedience. As soon as you talk about committing civil disobedience, they get a little upset. That's exactly the purpose of civil disobedience, to upset people, to trouble them, to disturb them. we who commit civil disobedience are disturbed too, and we mean to disturb those who are in charge of the war.
He said at the end of his speech, I remember, he said, now let me address the secret police in this crowd.
You agents of the FBI were circulating in the crowd. Hey, don't you see that you're violating the spirit of democracy by what you're doing? Don't you see that you're behaving like the secret police of a totalitarian state?
Well, that cost him a bit, I think, the next day. When we were sitting in front of the federal building, I have a feeling. Because, again, the police chose in the end to arrest almost no one. They didn't want arrest, they didn't want a trial, they didn't want the publicity that would be associated with that. They only arrested a couple of ringleaders, and one of those was Howard.
And so, let the spirit of disobedience spread to the war factories, to the battlefields, to the halls of Congress, every town and city, until the killing stops, until we can hold up our heads again before the world. Because our children deserve a world without war, and we ought to try to give them that.
And at that point, the batons were raised, and they began clubbing us very heavily. Howard was pulled up, as I say, his shirt was ripped apart, he was taken away, and I saw blood coming down his chest as he left.
Non-violent. We are going to be protesting against violence. We may break some petty laws. We may interfere slightly with business as usual, but these are not terrible crimes. There are terrible crimes being committed, but sitting down and locking arms, that's no terrible crime. War is a great crime of our age.
And here we must pause part two of our series on the life and times of historian, activist, and teacher Howard Zinn. The documentary is titled You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, and it's directed by Deb Ellis and Dennis Mueller. Tune in to New World Notes next week for part three, or find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding us all that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.